Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Dick Beeman. I'm your convener this morning. I'd like to welcome everybody to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. And I'd like to begin today with an introductory thought. Make the conscious decision to become an intentionally hopeful person and incorporate the practice of hopefulness into your daily routine. As hopefulness becomes a habit, you can achieve a permanently happy spirit. Again, good morning and welcome. The Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan is a diverse group that has no creed, no dogma, but we are guided by the seven principles listed on the back of your order of service. The Unitarian Fellowship is a welcoming congregation. We open our doors and our hearts equally to every person who enters the building, regardless of who you are or what brought you here, whether it was a spiritual or religious quest, a search for friendship or society, or simple curiosity about what these Unitarians are all about, which is something I haven't figured out, and I've been a Unitarian my entire life. I would like to extend a special welcome to visitors, and I encourage visitors to sign the guest book at the back of the room, at the front entrance, and to indicate whether you would like to receive our monthly newsletter. Are there any visitors who would like to be introduced and introduce themselves? Okay. The announcements are in your order. I'm sorry?
New lady coming in. I think she's signing the guest.
Oh, okay. Does she want to be introduced?
I'm new. I signed in. My name's Nancy Moore. I'm originally from Manhattan.
Oh, gosh. Hi. My name's Nancy Norp. I'm originally from Manhattan. Moving back here in the next few months, and I'm going around this summer to visit different places to see where I want to worship, to see where I want to go. Does that make sense? And this is embarrassing, so here's the microphone.
Welcome, Nancy. Anybody else want to introduce themselves? Any newcomers want to introduce themselves? Is there a hand up there?
Brand new. Oh, thank you. I'm brand new here in the town. This is my first Sunday in town, and I'm just here to investigate, join, do some little social justice work, that kind of thing.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Yes.
Oh, I'm Don Davis, and I've been a member here for a long, long time. In fact, I helped build that little thing down there.
Thank you. Okay. Nick, would you come and light the chalice, please? As we light the chalice today, let us contemplate the idea and the ideal of a balanced life, a balance of toil and rest, work and play, solemnity and frivolity, forethought and spontaneity, caution and pluck, community and solitude, teaching and learning, marching and dancing, doubt and faith. Are there joys and concerns?
I got a guest, and his name is Javier, and he's my cousin.
And we also have a concern in our family in that my oldest sister, Teresa, is reaching the end of her battle with breast cancer.
Judy Cattell, I just wanted to say, can you hear me now? I just wanted to say I was in Target and had bought quite a few things, and all of a sudden the checkout lady looked at my credit card and said, "This isn't going to work." And I said, "Well, it did Dylan's yesterday." And she said, "This is not going to work," and looked very bored and thought, "Oh, good Lord, here's another old lady." And so it just so happened that Kathy Hedge was just behind me. And so I said, Kathy, would you mind loaning me some money? She said, no, but I'll loan you my credit card. So I did not have to unload all my things from Target. And I was a little embarrassed and a little bit humiliated. But she stepped up to the plate. That's the spirit of UU.
I just want to report that Florence Schwab is in the hospital, and she might have had a minor stroke. She fell, and she's all bruised, but I couldn't see any other problems. She says she's having trouble speaking and finding words, but she'll be going into rehab at the hospital, I think maybe tomorrow. So keep her in your thoughts, and if you have a card or something, she would appreciate hearing from you, or if you want to stop by, she's ready for guests, too.
Hi, Ann Marchin. I just wanted to report my mother just had her 99th birthday on the 18th, and she said when she gets to be 100, she's going to smoke a cigarette and drink a beer. So.
I'm giving this little brief report on something that happened at Meadowlark, and it involves two other UU families besides my family. When we came here in 65, religion was rampant in the school system, and we heard a lot about it. My son, Roger, and Mike Lacey and Richard Dale managed to, with great effort, although the teachers, even though they didn't agree with them, were very nice to them, managed to get rid of a baccalaureate. My younger son worked alone and did a protest after the graduation that made the newspapers in the news services in the whole country. And they agreed, the school board agreed after that, not to have any more religious programs. They had been having religious assemblies regularly. And my younger son talked to the principal regularly after each one and told him he could not do this. They were bringing in Christian speakers rather than people who would advocate education. It was advocating Christianity and athleticism. And so, anyway, I was excoriated. My son was excoriated at the Verna Bell Cafe Thursday morning. I had gone down for some milk early, which I generally didn't. The place was jammed, and this woman, who is a resident at Meadowlark, said, "Did your son graduate in 72? And I said, "Well, I suppose. I don't remember the dates." And she said, "Well, he got rid of baccalaureate. Actually, it was my older son that did it." She said, "They're still talking about it to this day." I thought, right on.
This is more of an announcement. We are starting a Spiral Scouts troop in the area. And if you're not familiar with Spiral Scouts, it's similar to Boys and Girl Scouts, but it is not segregated by gender. It is completely open to all religions. It started out as being neo-pagan, but it is very open to every and all religions, all beliefs, creeds, and sexual genders and identities as well. And so if you, your children, your grandchildren are interested, because we are looking for volunteers, please see me after service. And we're starting up the program. It's going to be for children from ages from 3 to 18. And it's not going to be segregated by gender, only by age group. So all children will be able to participate in all activities. And we think that this would be a great fit for the UU and for the community. And so, like I said, if you're interested, please come see me after the service.
Ken Embers. My wife, Pat, and I have been married for 35 years, and my joy is that she's gone back to upstate New York, and I'm enjoying bachelorhood for a couple of weeks. My concern is that she went to a Native American sun dance, and she'll be chanting, singing, and dancing for 4 days without food and water.
Thank you. We are mindful that there are other joys and concerns that are unspoken. Now, let's sing a song.
Open the window, children, open the window now. Open the window, children, open the window, let the dove fly in. Open the window, let the dove fly in. Mama and a papa are fighting like snakes. Open the window, let the dove fly in. Baby is a-crying like her heart will break. Open the window, let the dove fly in. Open the window, children, open the window now. Open the window, children, open the window, let the dove fly in. Open the window, let the dove fly in. Neighbors lock their doors, build fences so high. Open the window, let the dove fly in. Don't see what's to discover on the other side. Open the window, let the dove fly in. Open the window, children, open the window now. Open the window, children, open the window, let the dove fly in. Open the window, let the dove fly in. Borders round countries, borders round the sky. Open the window, let the dove fly in. The only border close you is the border round your mind. Open the window, let the dove fly in. Open the window, children, open the window now. Open the window, children, open the window, let the dove fly in. Open the window, let the dove fly in. Some people have money, some people have none. Open the window, let the dove fly in. What's the use of money if your heart's gone numb? Open the window, let the dove fly in. Open the window, children, open the window now. Open the window, children, open the window, let the dove fly in. Open the window, let the dove fly in. This big old world is in a great big mess. Open the window, let the dove fly in. Open the window, find peace and rest. Open the window, let the dove fly in. Open the window, let the dove fly in.
Yeah. If the kids will come forward, our speaker today is going to share a little information with you.
Wow, what a great group of kids. I've got a question for you, a couple of questions to start with. One, I want to find out if you can tell me what this is.
Juggling.
Good, okay. And can some of you juggle like that?
No.
No? Would you like to know how?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I won't take time to teach you now, but I'm going to teach everyone else here after you go out of the room. But if you want to come after church, I'll be happy to share with you. But I am going to teach, I'm going to give them seven lessons on how to juggle. And I'm going to start by giving you the first lesson. And each one of these lessons has a lesson for life. Oh, let me ask, are any of you 9 years old? Okay. I was 9 years old when I learned to juggle. So it's not too early to start if you're interested in juggling. And so the first lesson is really a pretty simple one. You can do it. If you want to learn to juggle, start out with the assumption that you know how to do it, that you will learn it. Because if you start with the confidence and the assumption that you can do so, then you're much more likely to succeed than if you start by saying, oh, I could never learn to do that. That looks impossible. It's possible, and if you're interested in doing it, I've seen people the age of some of you learn how to juggle three objects in as short a time as 10 minutes. But a major part of it was that they started with the assumption that they could do it. It's sometimes said that the people that think they can do something and the people that think that they cannot are usually both right. When you start with the assumption that you will succeed, you're much more likely to do so. So in whatever you're doing during the coming week, if you start, try something new. But when you try it, think in the beginning, I can do this, and enjoy the experience of succeeding. Have a good week.
Go now in peace. Go now in
peace.
Courage is not the absence of fear or the opposite of fear. Rather, courage is maintaining one's optimism, confidence, and resoluteness in the face of fear, while acknowledging one's fear, in spite of one's fear. Similarly, doubt is not the opposite of faith or the absence of faith. Doubt is a recognition that every human being, no matter how intelligent or well-intentioned, no matter how revered, is susceptible to error and misconception. Doubt is a recognition that perfect truth extends beyond our current understanding. Doubt is being open to unending intellectual and spiritual growth while keeping faith in our ability to experience and benefit from such growth. Doubt is the beginning of wisdom, but faith is the twin sister of doubt. Without faith in the basic goodness and fairness of humankind, we are condemned to live in fear and suspicion. Without faith in our own capabilities, we are destined to fall short of our potential. Bill Richter, our speaker today, is retired from Kansas State University, where he was a member of the political science faculty, and he served in various administrative roles, including department head and associate provost for international programs. He's the author and co-author of books on administrative ethics, political thought, and K-State's Land and Lecture series. Most of his work abroad has been in India, Pakistan, and elsewhere in South Asia. Bill and his wife, Linda, also a retired KSU political scientist, have two married sons and four grandchildren. And as teenagers, by the way, both sons took the sex ed course offered to Unitarians and Congregationalists by Larry Weaver. But even more interesting than all of that is that Bill juggles, as you've seen. And that, of course, as all of us here know very well, automatically makes him cool and awesome. And most interesting of all, he has perceived in the practice of juggling a set of rules that can instruct us in not just how to juggle correctly, but how to live correctly, how to live a balanced, virtuous, happy, and successful life. So here is Bill Richter giving us the last set of life lessons learned from juggling that he started with the kids. Bill.
Thank you all for having me today. When Dick called and asked if I would speak, I gave him a set of topics, and I think that South Asian politics and administrative ethics were probably not at the top of the list. But when I mentioned the juggling, he said okay. So any shortcomings you find, you can blame Dick rather than me. I was thinking this morning, the last time I had a chance to preach at our own church, at the Congregational Church, I talked about the 117th and the 119th Psalms, which, if you happen to be familiar with that part of the Bible, are the shortest and the longest Psalms of the 150 that are in the Bible. And so I called it the long and the short of it, and you probably don't want to hear any more about that part of that sermon. This is sort of like a second church home to us. As Dick mentioned, our sons took the sex ed class when it was taught for both the children of this church and the children of our church. And that was, we were calculating this morning, about 25 years ago. And when our oldest granddaughter was born, about 19 years ago, my wife Linda sent a thank you note, or at least thanked Larry Weaver, because obviously the lessons worked. Juggling is a metaphor. We use these terms all the time about juggling our time, juggling our responsibilities, having too many balls in the air, worrying about dropping the ball, and so forth. Juggling is something that I have done for 65 years. I started as a kid when a relative came from Kansas to visit us where I lived in California, and he juggled three items that he carried around in his pocket, and I thought, that is the neatest thing. I'd like to try that. And I tried it, and it worked, later on, I'm going to give a little presentation to the music of Stars and Stripes Forever. You probably know that piece. It's funny how the years pass, but John Philip Sousa wrote Stars and Stripes Forever in December of 1896. I started performing in talent shows in junior high school in the early to mid-1950s. That means I've been juggling to this music for half of the life of the music. And that's sort of frightening to me about how long you can actually do something and not get any better at it, really. I mentioned to the kids that I had seven lessons. What I realized probably 20, 30 years ago was that you could teach juggling in a series of lessons, and each lesson would in turn be a metaphor for a lesson for life. And so what I'd like to do is to share those with you, and I've already mentioned the first of them, which is the attitudinal lesson that if you want to accomplish something, start out with the assumption that you can do it. And by the way, where possible, I'll also try to mention something concerning this church, because particularly with this lesson, I was reminded of the fact that this is a very can-do church. When I think about the leadership roles that some of your members have played in the Manhattan Alliance for Peace and Justice, for the anti-NBAF effort, for other efforts for peace and justice in the world, it really is a lesson perhaps that I don't even need to mention to you, because you incorporate it in the life of your church. The second lesson, the first one doesn't require any props. For the second one, I have some tennis balls to use as juggling props. The second lesson is, begin with the basics. And the basic in juggling is to, if you're wanting to juggle balls, is the toss of one ball, like this. Because if you put two of those together, you have this. And if you put three of them together, you have that. And so but the basic of juggling is the toss of one item. Oh, I'll do something I've never done before. The same thing is true if you're wanting to juggle pins. I was given these pins for my birthday, I think, 15 years ago, and I'm still learning how to juggle the pins. But you start with one, and you simply practice the toss, like that. And because eventually, I'm confident I can do it, you develop that skill to where it becomes habitual, and then it's possible to add to it until you're juggling two or more items. The same thing is true in life. You know, we all operate by a set of basics. They may be different from person to person. Some of us have, say, an ethical system that is based upon consequences. You know, we do those things that will lead to good results by our best judgment. Others operate according to rules or principles. But whatever it is, it's often important when things become too complex. This is, I find, particularly valuable when talking to high school students. When things become too complex, it's often valuable to break them down to their simplest pieces, to go down to the basic question, what is most important, and then to build up from there. Everything, like juggling, that looks complex is built up simple parts, whether it's an automobile or a wristwatch or a relationship. And knowing where the basics are and how to get to them is extremely valuable. Lesson number three is develop balance. I meant to ask in the beginning, I'll have a couple of questions for you now. How many of you juggle at least three items? Okay. I told Dick on the telephone the other day I would expect that there would be at least two or three, and I think four of you raised your hand. In this size group, normally I'd have you come up and go ahead and do the demonstration, but we'll hold off on that. My second question is, how many of you are left-handed? Okay, I would expect the number of left-handers to be a little more in this group. Usually about 10% of the population is left-handed. Most of us are either left-handed or right-handed. I'm not certain what I am. I write right-handed. All my life I've thrown left-handed. I started playing tennis in high school right-handed and switched when I figured out it felt better left-handed. In juggling, I am a little bit more left-handed than right-handed. It's easier for me to do it with the left hand than it is with the right. So for me, it's important in developing balance to work on the right side. To work on the weaker side. The same thing is true in life. It's important for us not to get overemphasized on one aspect of life and to neglect other parts of it. It's important to not to become too wound up in our work and to neglect the play side of life, or too wound up in play and to neglect the work side of life. It's valuable to develop all aspects of our lives, our mental and physical and social and spiritual sides, so that we are whole people. Because without doing that, we become unbalanced, and that is not as healthy. Some of the people that write about juggling argue that ambidexterity, juggling encourages ambidexterity, and ambidexterity is valuable for developing both sides of the brain. You know how the left side of the brain controls the right side of the body and vice versa. The argument is that developing the practice of juggling helps to develop both sides of the brain and therefore is also contributes to good health. Lesson number 4 is timing is important. A lot of people, when they're first learning to juggle, the question is, when do you toss the second ball? Some people toss it too soon, and then you have both balls coming down at the same time. Some people toss it too late, and then you're trying to catch the first ball as you're trying to toss the second ball. And the answer in juggling is since it takes the same amount of time for the ball to go up as it takes to come down, although it's never moving at the same pace any place along the way. If you're a physicist, you know what I'm saying. There's a formula for the speed of a ball. But so what you do is you toss the second ball when the first one is at the top of its arc. So if you watch, as the ball comes to a stop, and that's the point at which you toss the second ball. And that maintains a certain rhythm to the juggling. Well, again, the same sort of thing is true in life. Timing is important. This is probably, of the 7 lessons, the one I have the greatest difficulty with. I tend to procrastinate. It's an old habit, and so a lot of things I don't do until I like to refer to it as just-in-time behavior. But it's not always the best way to do it. It's all, especially in such things as saying thank you, doing things that other people are expected to have done, doing things that other people depend upon. It's valuable to be timely in our actions. Rhythm is also important. I mentioned some of the things that some of you do in this church. Anna Franklin, is Anna here today? Anna's work with yoga. Yoga is something that some of the rest of you may be involved with yoga, but since I learned yoga from her father 40 years ago or so, I have found that a way of sort of getting in tune with the rhythms of life. It is valuable at times when things get too hectic simply to take a deep breath and try to align the rhythm of our life with the rhythm of the universe. And so in that sense, rhythm is also in juggling. Some people juggle and make music, juggle in a way that you can pound out a tune. Juggling and music and other rhythmic things are satisfying by their, it's sort of fun to do. Lesson number 5 has to do with the question of where do you look when you're juggling? Where do you keep your eyes? Do you watch this hand or that ball? And the lesson is get the big picture. You don't watch any individual hand. You don't watch any individual ball. What you watch is the whole, what I watch anyhow, is the whole process. I'll show you. If I'm doing like this, I don't even see my hands. The hands basically go where they need to go in order to catch the ball. I look at the apex of where the balls are, and everything else sort of falls into place. Well, again, in life, it's valuable. Too often, we, in a family, in an organization, in a church, in the university, we become so wrapped up with our piece of the action, with our tree in the forest, that we lose sight of the whole forest. We lose sight of the whole organization. We lose sight of the overall purpose and where we fit into it. In fact, I think that is probably much more a tendency than to go in the other direction and just look at the forest. And so it's oftentimes important to stop ourselves and say, wait a second, how does what I'm doing fit into what everybody else is doing? How is this a part of the whole? And to think of life in those terms. Lesson number 6 is add variety. Once you have the basics of juggling down, I think every juggler will add certain things to the routine. You know, I mentioned I'm still working on adding pins to the routine. I added one thing about a year ago that I thought I might show you, and that would be juggling 3 balls with one hand. Just a second. Actually, I have juggled 3 balls loose with one hand, but I'm not going to do it as part of the demonstration today. Well, again, the same thing is true of life. There are, once we have the basics taken care of, it's valuable to add those things that enrich our lives. The arts, the association with other people, to take time to enjoy the land around us, to do those things that are not necessary, not the basics, but are an advancement on that. It's one of the things I admire about those of you who have who play instruments or who sing in groups. That is a way of enriching the lives that we have. Finally, the 7th lesson is practice, practice, practice. As a kid, I can remember spending hours over standing by my bed so that if I dropped the balls, and I would inevitably drop them, I would juggle to the point where I would have to drop them. They would fall on the bed, and I wouldn't have to go chasing very far for them. It is through practice that the things that we do become habitual. Aristotle, you may recall, in his Nicomachean Ethics, said that the word the word for ethics and the word for habit are related. You know, ethics to Aristotle was good habits, developing those behaviors that become habitual that are beneficial to ourselves and others. So in life generally, whatever we would do, whatever we would be, we must practice. I've studied various languages in the past, and the best language teachers that I had were the ones that made me practice. Who didn't just tell me about the language, but who had us practicing from the beginning on whatever language. Whether it's a language or a musical instrument or a sport, it's valuable to practice to become the best we can in it. I mentioned to Dick recently that I had the pleasure of reading Malcolm Gladwell's book, Outliers. I don't know how many of you are familiar with it. Gladwell is a fascinating writer, and Outliers concerns people with abilities that we tend to think of as being exceptional. But what Gladwell said was, for most of these individuals, and you start with a certain amount of talent, but ultimately it is a matter of having a lot of practice. He pointed to Bill Gates, he pointed to the Beatles, as in each case said, they all had 10,000 hours of practice at what they were doing before they became recognized as being great. And so that practice is important. Of course, choosing the things we practice is also important. So in the coming days and weeks, I sometimes forget this, and I need to myself work on practicing more of the things that I would like to be and in practicing fewer of the things that I would, in my heart of hearts, know I probably should not be. And those, so I encourage all of you to give thought to those seven lessons, whether you're wanting to learn how to juggle or not. I think I meant to mention to the kids, but didn't, that I would be happy to stick around after church and give people a chance to try tennis balls, bean bags, other things that I have in my bag here, and provide, give people a chance to juggle if you would like. What I'd like to do at this point, then, is to wind up by giving a a little presentation with just the tennis balls. And I mentioned it's to the music of John Philip Sousa. If you are not happy with martial music, and particularly if, I doubt if very many people know John Philip Sousa's lyrics to Stars and Stripes Forever. But if you're not happy with martial music, think of the other lyrics to this music that begin with, be kind to your web-footed friends. Anyone know the next line? I thought in this group I would have some others who, for a duck, maybe somebody's mother. Yes.
And finally, if I drop the balls, don't worry about it. I've done it before. I will just try to retrieve them and finish the process.
Plenty of time for discussion and questions. Yes.
So did you always have the seven rules since you were nine, or
no,
those developed over time?
Those, the question was, did I always have the seven rules? And no, I really developed those sometime in the 1990s, I think. And what happened was, you know,
did you all hear the question earlier? Okay, the question was, did I always have the seven rules since I started juggling in the 1940s, or did I develop them earlier? And I developed them earlier. Actually, it started, I ran across another juggler at a public administration meeting. And she and I talked about sort of application of rules for juggling to rules to administrative ethics. And so I've done this, the same sort of lessons, but tied to administrative ethics before. But sometime in the 1990s or so, I used to go out and give talks around the state as part of the presidential lecture series at K-State, which, you know, I'd go talk about political science or South Asia or something else of interest. And one year, almost as a lark, I put in lessons for life from juggling as a topic. And I think 90% of the presentations I gave after that were on juggling. Nobody wanted to hear about political science or South Asia. Other questions?
Can you just drop this in your pocket?
Okay. Okay. Yes.
What do you think about the
I'll repeat the question. The question was, what do I think about when I'm juggling? Well, it's You know, some of the time, if I'm just doing it for myself, you almost go into a trance mode. You know, you don't think about anything. When I'm doing it for you, when I'm doing it, you know, in a presentation, part of what I'm thinking about is, well, I hope I don't drop the ball. I also was thinking about the fact that I was glad I took my glasses off, because I did a presentation to a district Rotary conference about a year ago, and I had my glasses on, and there were spotlights like this. And so normally I will toss the balls a little higher, but when I was doing it here just now, the lights were a bit of an impediment, so I didn't do that as much. So you make a few adjustments, but it's... Yes, and I'm also sort of, thinking, well, now, you know, is it time to do this? Am I doing this too long? Am I boring everyone? You know, these various thoughts sort of crop up in the process. But interesting question. Yes. Oh, yes.
But if you listen, some people are new here. If you don't use the microphone, people with the headsets can't hear, and if you don't use the microphone, it doesn't get recorded. So it's okay. There's a reason for this. You began by having some nice things to say about us, and I would like to return the favor. Last fall, I got together with Gretchen Lewis, who's the choir director at First Congregational, and started talking to her about the possibility of doing a joint concert. And we moved toward doing that. And in the process of preparing for it, several Sundays, I went to, when I didn't have the choir singing, I went to the First Congregational Church, and I was there. In fact, I know quite a bit about the shortest and the longest a book of Psalms, because I was there that Sunday. I heard it. I can't repeat it, but I heard it. What I found in this process of getting to know that congregation better and working with several people there, sticking around afterwards for coffee or for refreshments and so on, and listening to what I heard, what I would say I came away with this impression that when theology was explicitly discussed, it didn't match mine. But when the implications of that theology came out, they were identical to mine. And also, and as you said, talking about seeing us involved in good causes, I saw lots of people that I knew but had no idea where they might go to church, who were also actively involved. And so I would say our congregations are on a par for what we do for the good of this community.
Thank you.
It was a great experience.
Mike. I had intended to mention, with relation to lesson number 6, Add Variety, that wonderful concert that you and Gretchen put together that was held right here. And I hope most of you were able to attend that, because but that was exactly the sort of thing that, you know, over and above the things that we do in our daily lives, that's the sort of thing that remembers because it enriches. Yes.
Oh, okay.
Where's the...
The mic's phone's
oh, yes.
over here.
Okay,
I have a question, but I'm going to ask a different kind of question if I don't get booed down. But I was pleased to speak at the Rotary Peace Conference that you had and invited me to, and I spoke on... my Library Learning Center project in Vietnam, and you mentioned that you'd written about administrative ethics, and my question is that in Vietnam, when you do things through the bureaucracy, through the government, many, many people are very disappointed that it requires some under-the-table money to get anything done. Would you comment on that?
Sure. I spent a total of 4 years or so in India and Pakistan. And I think the term in India is bakshish. Yeah. You know, and I'm not sure how widespread that is, but basically It can stand for everything from a tip to a bribe. There were times I didn't get what I wanted, but I never gave a bribe. There were plenty of opportunities. If you wanted something to do that. There are scholars who have written in defense of bribery as a way of making certain types of societies operate effectively. I tend to think that the downside is worse than the benefits of that sort of thing. So I should also mention, in 1990, I was doing a democracy assessment in Pakistan on a U.S. Government contract. And I interviewed people at the U.S. Information Service office in Islamabad. And when I raised the question of ethics, they laughed. I mean, why? Everyone in the room thought the idea of talking about ethics in Pakistan was a joke. I think it has become much more recognized as a problem in Pakistan, as a problem in Afghanistan, and as a problem elsewhere that hampers development and hampers progress within the country. Does that respond to your?
Yeah, thank you.
Great. Yes.
Yeah. Don't look. But have you ever coached baseball batters?
Have I ever coached baseball batters? No. I've played baseball, and I normally batted left-handed, but I also batted right-handed. But I always threw left-handed. Why the question on baseball?
It's very popular.
It is. Well, and also there are a lot of metaphors with baseball, as there are with juggling. Yes.
I'm Bobette McGoy. Many of you know that recently Buddy suffered a stroke, as have several members of our congregation. And it was interesting, in occupational therapy, one of the exercises they had him do was juggling.
Really?
Because it's a good coordination brain exercise. He hasn't mastered it, but it certainly was interesting to see that incorporated.
Good. It, you know, the body remembers things that we are not consciously aware of. If you're learning a language, it's sometimes valuable to write. I find it helpful to write out vocabulary words, because the very act of writing reinforces the purely mental thing of looking at a word and remembering it. We have a good friend who plays the piano and suffered a series of strokes a year or so ago. She still plays the piano, even though she may have difficulty remembering other things, because there is a physical memory, I'm convinced, that is in many ways as powerful as the mental memory that we have in life. Yes.
Oops.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Jim Chanteau.
Hi, Jim.
Hi. Your story very much mimics my story in music, actually, although I'm not a juggler, but about the same age, I started playing, and throughout my life, I've continued in musical activities. But in thinking back on it, what I realize is virtually every key choice point I came to in my life was influenced by music, even though it was a professional choice. It had to do with my career, or even coming to K-State, for instance. All were influenced by music. I'm wondering if that's the same sort of thing you've experienced with juggling.
I'm not sure. That's a good question. And I usually tell people who play instruments or sing, that you have real talent. This is just, this is fun talent. But but not necessarily of the sort that you folks have. Artists also, I think, I have great admiration for. When I was a kid, I dreamed of having a unicycle, juggling on the unicycle and joining the circus. I'm grateful now that I didn't join the circus, but I still sort of regret never having had a unicycle. This was, I thought of making my own since we didn't have the money to buy a unicycle. I didn't know where to buy one and so forth. I suppose I've gone for years without juggling at times. I did it in junior high and high school in talent shows. I probably did it some in college. I may not have done it much in the years following college. I've probably done more juggling in the last 20 years, thanks to the seven lessons. And some of those have really been satisfying experiences. I did one program for a high school in a town, can't even remember which town it was. It wasn't Greensburg, but it was a town that had been hit by a tornado. And I got the sweetest letters from not only the students but the teacher on how much this had meant to them in the wake of that experience of the tornado. I've done the presentation for preschoolers in the Wonder Workshop, and have gotten these beautiful handwritten thank you notes that are about this big, and I can't say that it has modified my career the way that yours has, but it certainly enriched it. Yes.
How many different things have you juggled?
yeah, at once, you mean? What sorts of things have I juggled?
What sorts of things?
Well, as a kid, I would pick oranges off the tree and juggle them on the way to school. Then I'd hide the oranges, and then I'd find them after school and juggle. I lived about a mile from the school, through town. People must have been very tolerant in that town. I have juggled eggs. I've never juggled anything really dangerous, I don't think. The most items that I've juggled at one time are four. I could juggle three different size and different weight objects. That's fairly easy, but I don't do it. Usually I don't do it in a presentation because I like the bouncing off the floor, and I can't do a beanbag off the floor. It just doesn't work.
The reason I asked, juggling came up in my mind the other day, and not so much in juggling objects. I wait on people, so I may be juggling phone calls or waiting on people. And it's a really tough job because I may have three people out here to wait on, and the phone's ringing at me, and I actually lost somebody the other day because of that. They walked off upset, and so because I had several people I was trying to wait on and answer the phone at the same time. So I learned something new about that. My neighbor told me, said, well, if that phone rings and you're waiting on somebody in order not to upset this person because you've taken your attention off of them, why, then you would ask them, may I take this phone call? That way you've asked their permission.
Sure. Or say, excuse me, to the person you're talking to, answer the phone, say, can I have you wait for a second while I deal with this person? You do have to develop skills in juggling time and responsibilities and people and other sorts of things. That are somewhat like the skills of juggling.
And all people have different expectations. Some people will wait patiently while you take care of something else. Some people won't.
Yes.
So another point I wanted to bring up, I think we're all jugglers. We all do some kind of juggling in our life. And whether it's juggling, do I take care of this problem first or this problem first? Or do I take care of this concern first?
Sure.
You know, and and you have to get a feel for it. And sometimes we make mistakes.
That's right. And I have dropped the ball in many sorts of situations, which is why, it's not part of the lessons. But when you drop the ball, if you're practicing things, it's valuable to practice enough to the point where you make mistakes, or to practice things that you make mistakes in, so that, because if you don't do that, you never get any better. And so mistakes are a valuable part of improvement of anything that we do, whether it's dealing with people or dealing with juggling balls. Yes?
I'm Elke Lorenz. I'm always interested when people mention language learners, since I'm a language teacher. We always practice grammar drills with a racquetball. It takes the boredom out. We can juggle. Maybe I should introduce that. But it would be chaotic. But it really helps the students just to bounce a ball when going through kind of boring drills. It takes it out. So.
Great.
And I got that from Pat Embers' Bellavistic workshop a long time ago.
Ken Embers again. My question is, how does your costume affect you psychologically, your outfit, when you put your hat on? How important is that to your performance, and how important is it to differentiate yourself from your audience?
You mean the hat?
Or is it just fun?
For many years, I did this without the hat. We were in Prague, I think, in 2001, and found this hat for sale and decided that would be great. I have another hat that is black and looks sort of like a top hat, except if you take it off and reach inside, you can pull out a white rabbit that's sort of hidden inside. And the hat, it's just sort of for the humor effect. It's a little bit like juggling the three balls in one hand. It seems to work a little bit.
I was watching you and, kind of empathizing with how it must feel to add these different things. In other words, the basic juggling, that would get so built in. But then suddenly to raise the ball up and down like this or bring the ball across just seemed like it must be extra difficult. Is that...
the question is, what about these added routines? And I mentioned earlier that adding variety, those are two of the sort of adding variety things. This is no more difficult than this. It's basically, I just raise what, looks a little like I'm doing something, but it's not any more difficult. This is a little more difficult, but I found that it would work. Now, I haven't been able to do it in the right hand. I have never. I'm not going to try it now either. But I haven't. So it's again one of the indications that I'm more able left-handed than right on that. But in terms of difficulty, it's the same rhythm. This rhythm back. I'm hitting the mic here. This rhythm back and forth, and the rhythm of throwing the balls is the same. So once you get it, then it's not any more difficult. The bouncing off the floor, sometimes pairs of jugglers will toss things to one another. The floor acts in the same way that gravity does. If I toss the ball up, gravity sends it back to my hand. If I toss the ball down, the reflexivity of the floor tosses it back up. And so you can juggle against a wall. Juggling in space would be a challenge, because nothing would throw it back to you. But otherwise, it's a matter just of developing the habit. There are certain things I have done in juggling that I don't do in presentations because they're not dependable enough. I haven't practiced them enough. I used to toss a ball from behind my back like that. Well, it doesn't add that much to the aesthetics of it, so I don't do that.
I can juggle two balls in my left hand and two balls in my right hand, but not long enough that I would be confident that I wouldn't drop them in the process of a presentation. So there's some things that still remain more difficult than others. And I vow sometime I'm going to be able to do the pins. I've got to the point where I can toss one and toss another, but I don't do three of them yet.
Tom Manny.
Hey, Tom. Yes.
You mentioned juggling eggs, mm-hmm. which I assume were raw eggs.
Yes.
And that reminded me of, for some strange reason, my first physics teacher, who encouraged us to work our physics problems in ink. And I wondered if you considered juggling with eggs to be a good incentive for beginners.
I would not recommend, in the recognition that dropping is likely until you develop the habits, I would not recommend raw eggs for beginners. It might be better over the bed than over this floor, because the floor is harder. On Sunday morning, I go get the paper, and there are two puzzles that I like to work we get the Kansas City Star and the Mercury on Sunday morning. And I like to do the what's called Numbrix in the Parade magazine, and I like to do the Ken in the Kansas City Star magazine. And I do them both in ink. The first 3 days of the week when I do the Sudoku, I do those in ink. I don't do in pencil on a newspaper Sudoku. But the latter part of the week, I will do it in pencil on a piece of paper. So I guess I'm not totally confident in some of those things.
Right here, Bill. Bill.
Oh, yes.
I've only recently been thinking about my left-handedness, because I write and eat with my left hand, but mm-hmm. I do everything else with my right hand, and I have only started to think about it recently because my right wrist and my right thumb are pretty worn out.
I would encourage you to try doing some of the things with the other hand that you... I know, when I've had rotator cuff surgery in both shoulders, and it's astounding when you lose control of one hand how many things you're dependent upon that hand for. Handedness is a funny thing. They say that those who are left-handed are more prone to accident than right-handers. And that there is probably, there's a greater risk. Left-handedness is a risk factor. Part of it has to do with the way in which the world is structured for right-handers.
I hate to interrupt, but we're just at the end of our time. Let's give Bill a hand for this wonderful presentation. And I want to thank Bill especially for extending the range of what is now considered possible and appropriate for a Unitarian sermon. Last song is 311, Let It Be a Dance.